Blog Talk Radio.
Down to this, after many months, the world converges on the San Francisco Bay Area for the largest event in the country. It's the Beer Week, and when I say Beer Week, there's over 800 events throughout the Bay Area. And when you think of San Francisco Bay Area, it's north, which is Santa Rosa. San Francisco Bay Area, San Francisco, San Jose, Oakland, Berkeley, Fremont. And then you get into the smaller cities like Santa Cruz. And each of those cities is celebrating beer, and not just beer in the form of commercial beer. We're talking about craft beer. And those of you who have been listening along know that I'm a fan. I'm a real aficionado of beer. I have a group called Bay Area Beer Socials, and I mean we're hosting probably 15 events. But when people think of craft beer, they have to remember this, and this is just a little breakdown. Craft beer is artisanal brewing. These are small batch brews, very 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 flavorful. The ones that are outstanding usually bottle, you know, a few thousand. Some of them, the specialty brewers here in the Bay Area, don't even brew, bottle. They just, you know, distribute it among some restaurants. But it's a big deal, and it's San Francisco Beer Week. And the thing to remember about craft beer, artisanal beer, is you're not pouring a liter of beer, which is a stein, you know, like you do at Oktoberfest. These are small wine glass size glasses that you sip and sample. And some of these beers are outstanding. And I've mentioned it before, when you go to a store out here, there's like Beverages and More and Whole Foods. I'm trying to think of some. Oh, Trader Joe's. If you have a Trader Joe's in your area, check out a craft beer sometime, and you'll see that they're a little more expensive. But when you start getting into craft beer, they become like little jewels, and it's an amazing phenomenon that's been growing here. And the Bay Area is one of the largest producers of these craft beers. So, hey, I'm looking forward to it. And yesterday was the first day, and it'll go for a week. And everybody who's anybody here in the Bay Area is having an event. Restaurants are doing beer pairings. There's samplings in stores lots of small festivals. And then there's a couple of big festivals that are kind of concluding the week. So I am a fan of craft beer. Thousands and thousands of people. When the Bay Area's got like 5 million people. And I think last year they estimated about, maybe 250,000 people, closer to 300,000 were indulging in sampling. So that's what it's all about right now for me. So, hey, hope you're doing well. Hey, Earth Ancients is sponsored by Gaia, and Gaia continues to produce a number of really, really fascinating programs. This week, there's a double episode, and there's also the premiere of Linda Howe's Truth Hunter, and it's Revelations from Alien Encounters. And she is a research investigator best known for her work with animal mutilations and a lot of sightings. But if you go to Gaia, if you go to gaia.com/earthancients, you can join this program, and it's 99 cents for the first month. And after that, it's about $9. But there's a ton of first run quality programs. And they're also presenting another series from Greg Braden, which is the Missing Links program. Wisdom Teachings by Dave Wilcox, Cosmic Disclosure, which is David Wilcox and Corey Good, and then George Norrie of Coast to Coast fame is launching a new program called Beyond Belief. So to get all this and get access to 7,000 programs, go to Gaia, GAIA.com/earthancients and check it out. It's quite an amazing collection of material, everything from ancient wisdom traditions to NASA's secret space program. So check it out. For those of you who didn't listen to the program last week, Richard Cassero, the guest on the program, offered me an access point to an ebook that he wrote called The Cathedral Code. Now, the cathedrals were part of the program and last week, and this ebook is about, I think it's about 14 or 15 pages, and it is quite unique in that it describes the sacred geometry that's built in the cathedrals and also what he believes some of the energetics were that were built in to the design, so that when you go to, say, the Notre Dame in Paris or the Reims Cathedral, which is also the Notre Dame of Reims in Paris, France, or Reims, France, which is outside of Paris, these cathedrals are quite unique, not only for their design, but through the energetics built into them. And you can get this ebook by going to earthancients.com and registering. And when you register, you'll get on the newsletter. And I'm sending out a second newsletter, a second batch of newsletters in about 24 hours. So make sure you get on there. And I have to excuse me. I didn't get the newsletter out as quickly as I had hoped, but I will get it out again. So if you didn't get it in January, you'll get it in the next 24 hours. So lots to see.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
And we got a lot to talk about. There's a tremendous amount of discovery going on in South America. And about a month ago, there was an article that I've posted on the Facebook, a number of massive Amazonian geoglyphs. And these are glyphs that have been discovered during the damaging of forests. In other words, there's deforestation going on. And what's happening is, as the land is drying, they're discovering the remains of a very ancient civilization in South America, specifically the Amazon region. And what they found is right now it's 450 massive geoglyphs, which are stone structures that are spread out about 8,000 miles dotting those areas. And they estimate that these geoglyphs are about 2,000 years old or older. And it's quite amazing when you consider that here's a whole civilization that's lost to us and that we really don't know the originating points of this civilization, other than to say we have these foundations. And now they're going to go in there and start doing some archaeological digs to see who these people were. where they came from and why they built these areas. So check that out. That's on Facebook. It's quite interesting, actually. There is a video, Pyramid Cultures in Indonesia and Central America, that was produced by Richard Casero, who was the guest last week. And this is a video where he is showing similarities in the pyramids of Mexico and also Indonesia. And there are a lot of people that claim that a lot of these Balinese and other Indonesian pyramids are very similar to Mayan pyramids. And as somebody who studied the Mayan culture for, you know, three decades and their archaeology, I do see some similarities. I do see the possibility of it. I don't see direct links. Now, what I do think happened is that there was a template that was distributed around the world, and this is, oh God, thousands of years ago. And this template was something that was gave the builders an opportunity to expand on. And I see the possibilities of a template used in Balinese and Mayan pyramid complexes, but they're not quite exactly the same. I think there's a lot of reinterpretation when you look at this, but check it out. Pyramid Cultures of Indonesia and Central America. It's a video by, like I said, Richard Casero. Quite unique. And I think it's continuing his research, and he's a great researcher. So the other thing that's quite interesting is I was in Paris recently, as you know, and I had a chance to go to the Branly Museum, and they have a America collection of artifacts that I found were quite unique. I think I took over 400 photographs of these American artifacts, and there's a series of artifacts that are quite unique, and I posted a photo gallery called The Equator, South America, Out of Place Artifacts, and this one sculpture is quite unique, of an individual who is very, very much out of place, simply because not only is the carving, which is estimated to be 2,500 or older years, it's quite unique, quite modern carving, but he's wearing a very sophisticated helmet. And on the helmet, there are advanced design. There's features on there that look like some kind of technology, a device to this individual's ears. And I was so fascinated, I took a number of photographs of it, and I placed it in this gallery that you can see on Facebook. So you got to go to Facebook, you go to Earth Ancients, and it's a small, very refined, very stylistic head that I've just never seen it before, and it's very, very much out of place, because the other sculptures that are in the museum in that same time period are not even close to looking like this. And there's so many cultures that have come and gone that we just don't know about, that, you know, I mean, some people believe that they're off-world people that came and visited. I'm more of the belief that they came, they developed a high culture, and may have, through disease or warfare or assimilation, you know, eventually were, you know, they're basically changed. That was it. They're gone. So anyhow, check it out. Earth Ancients Facebook page. Go to the group, and you can see this and so much more. Every week, you should check out what we got in terms of material, because there is a lot to look at. Each week, week we have contributors to our Facebook page, and some of these people are actual scientists. We have a lot of research investigators, and then just regular Joes, as I call them, the people that are just interested in material that they find interesting and send it in to me. And this past week, one of our members named Derek Olson sent in quite an interesting group of images from Nevada and the historic memory of a native culture here. And I gave him a call, and this is the quick interview we did based on his research. We have a lot of contributors to our Facebook page, Earth Ancients Facebook, and a recent contributor, a member, his name is Derek Olson, presented a really interesting article, and I wanted to talk a little bit about it. The title, and he runs a, by the way, he runs a website. It's called Megalithic Marvels, Reconstructing the Prehistoric Past, and I suggest you go take a look at that. But he posted an interesting article about some giants that were listed in a native culture's past. Actually, the title of this article was Unlocking Lovelock, Attack of the Red-Haired Giants. And I wanted to talk to Derek a little bit about this. Derek, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, Cliff.
Yeah. Hey, so I really like your website here, and this article was quite interesting. When did you discover this oral tradition about these red-haired giants that were in Nevada, of all places?
Yeah, so several years ago, I was living in the Sacramento area, and I was just doing research. This was back before I had a blog, but I was, you know, really into these subjects, and I came across somehow this legend of the red-haired giants at Lovelock, in Lovelock Cave, and it really intrigued me. And so I did more research, and then I had a free weekend coming up, and I talked all my buddies into going out to Lovelock Cave. And
okay,
so that's really where I got into this.
Okay, where now? Where's Lovelock?
So Lovelock is about 93 miles east of Reno, Nevada.
Okay.
And it's just right around this little town called Lovelock, and the cave's actually, I believe, like 22 miles southwest, way out in the middle of nowhere from the
town.
Yeah,
I'm looking at this photograph that you posted. It's like a desert. I don't see any. I guess the caves are in the foothills that you see out in the distance of this photo.
Yeah, so I mean, it's almost like it's very bizarre. You're in the middle of nowhere. I mean, you might even think you're on Mars, you know, with some of these pictures of the area. But do you want me to recount the legend real quick?
Yeah, tell us about the legend, because that's the meat of it. So tell us all about it.
Right. So the Northern Paiutes of Nevada have this ancient oral tradition that they have passed down literally from generation to generation. And they state that ages ago, they had a ferocious enemy known as the Sitika. And here's where it gets fascinating, is that the Paiutes say that the Sitika were this race of red-haired cannibalistic giants that would literally eat their enemies. And the chronicle goes on that after, you know, like I believe it's about 3 years of these bloody battles, a coalition of regional tribes, they finally come together to conquer the enemy, and they push the Sitika back into this huge cave.
Mm-hmm.
And as the giants are in the back of the cave, they quickly pile the entrance with brush, they set it ablaze, and they're, you know, start to suffocate them and smoke them out. And as these giants are trying to escape, there's a fury of arrows being shot at them.
Wow.
And eventually the giants meet their fate in a blazing inferno. And so that's kind of the meat of the original legend.
But the thing that's interesting, though, is that to kind of verify, and I mean, it's not just a myth, As you write, one of the daughters of the chief, Sarah Winnie Muka, talks about the hair that they took from these fallen adversaries, and they used this hair on in their clothing, which I find quite interesting. And somebody who could find one of her, those dresses or outfits could verify the DNA on one of these giants. But anyhow, talk a little bit more about that.
So you've got the oral tradition, right? And then you've got the written account of Sarah Winnemucca, who is the daughter of Chief Winnemucca. Back in 1883, she writes the first ever autobiography by a Native American woman. It's called Life Among the Paiutes. And in her book, she discusses this tribe that they were the Paiutes called the, quote, people eaters, unquote. And in her memoir, she literally makes this statement, and I'll read it because it's what you're referring to. She says, quote, "My people say that the tribe we exterminated had reddish hair. I have some of their hair, which has been handed down from father to son. Mm-hmm. I have a dress which has been in our family a great many years, trimmed with this reddish hair. I'm going to wear it sometime when I lecture. It is called a mourning dress, and no one has such a dress but my family." End quote.
Yeah, amazing.
So pretty crazy because, from those, from the oral tradition and in the written account, you know, the two big questions that pop into my head is, number one, because the skeptics say, oh, the Sitka were just some other tall enemy tribe. But there's some genetic anomalies obviously going on here in the context of the situation. Number one being, why did they have red hair and not black hair like all the other indigenous tribes? And two, why would one of the most influential Paiute families of the region save the hair and carefully pass it down generation to generation and trim their most treasured garments with it if it was just some normal?
Yeah. So tell us about what you discovered when you went out to the cave. Did you actually get into the cave, or what did you see?
I did. So it's crazy. We go out to the cave, and, I mean, literally you're in the middle of nowhere. And you've got to search hard for where this is because there's no signs playing the way anywhere. It's almost as if they don't want you to find it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And you kind of start elevating up these hills, and then you see it sitting up there like an ancient fortress. And so Lovelock Cave is situated in a small peak of outcrop. It's of limestone. Hmm. And when you walk up to it, it's literally like you're going back in time. And as we entered the cave, I got this like timeless otherworldly vibe. And the cave is massive. It's like 150 feet in length and 30 feet wide. So it's a really big cave, and the state has built a deck in there that you can walk around inside because they obviously don't want people like digging around the corners.
Yeah.
But the most striking thing you notice when you enter this cave is the ceiling is literally charred black from fire.
Oh, wow. So it wasn't the fable. Yeah.
So yeah, that immediately corroborates the legend, right?
Yes.
And so it's just this massive cave, and if you want, I can kind of go into some of the crazy stuff that has been found in it. Where do you want to go?
Yeah,
from here?
Tell us. What have they found? The bones? That's the bottom line. Is we want these bones of these giants. Everybody who we've had on this program says, well, the Smithsonian has taken the bones and we've never seen them again, or various prospectors take a bone or move them around and we never see them. But we need, you know, I mean, the bottom line is we need to see evidence of these giants. So go ahead. What did you find?
Dr. Gene Hattori, he's the curator of anthropology at the Nevada State Museum. Mm-hmm. And he makes this statement on an amazing pestle that was found. He says, we recently received a donation of a pestle that was found below the mouth of Lovelock Cave. And it is extraordinarily large and very heavy. And you can see the video of this. And I'll have it in my next blog. It is much larger than we usually find. It was found below Lovelock Cave and well within the Sitka territory. So this could have been one of the pestles used by the red-headed giants and might account for its large size because of the large people that were using it. End quote.
Okay.
Pretty amazing that you know, the curator of anthropology is making that statement, and this thing is huge. So Clow and what's the other guy's name? Harrington, who did the original excavations, they mention, you know, 3,000 to 4,000 years old.
Okay.
In their book. However, mm-hmm. based on some other discoveries in Spirit Cave, which isn't far, Spirit Man, which I can hit on if there's time, who has like, you know, Norse, who many anthropologists believe has Norse bloodlines, he was predated, you know, like 10,000 years old.
Hmm.
So there's all these skeletons that have been found in the area. And so let's talk about the skeletons real quick.
Sure.
So, I mean, okay, let me pull up my notes here. Loud, Scher, and Harrington have two photos that are pretty shocking. And one is this giant-looking skull that looks very European in features.
Mm-hmm.
And the other photo is of a baby child, okay? And when you look at this baby skeleton, what's crazy is it looks like it's got a humanoid-type head.
Okay.
Like you see almost in some of these skulls that have been found in Peru.
Oh, the elongated skull, you mean?
Well, yeah, there's some that are elongated but have that humanoid look in the face, and this one definitely, upon first glance, you're like, that doesn't look normal. And so I'll have those photos up as well, but obviously those two photos don't get a lot of press or mention. In their book, Loud and they reference James H. Hart, who was the first miner in the cave digging around. Mm-hmm. And this is a pretty crazy quote that Hart shares in the book. He says, in the south end of the cave, about 20 feet deep, we unearthed some skeletons. In the north central part of the cave, about 4 feet deep, was a striking-looking body of a man, 6'6" tall. His body was mummified and his hair distinctly red. The man was a giant, end quote.
Wow.
So there's a quote from one of the first miners. And then there's all these other reports that they found a giant measuring 8 feet tall and another one 6.5 feet tall.
Amazing.
It's pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah. So this is out in Nevada, which is interesting because this is the first time I've heard of natives describing giants in Nevada. And this is northern Nevada.
And
we've had a number of people on the show who talked about different regions of the country. The mound builders, the original mound builders may have been giants. But this is interesting. So, well, fantastic. We're definitely going to link that. If you could get those photos to me, I'll put them up for our audience. And
absolutely.
Continued success with this, Derek. This megalithic marvels is fantastic. This first photograph that you have here is, I mean, this Lovelock Cave, I'm just going to call it a mesa. It looks more like a desert, but it's huge.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's a picture from the front of the cave. And, it is fascinating. And, I've got part one already up on my blog. I'll have parts two up tomorrow and then probably 3 and 4, you know, really chronicling each part chronologically. And it's going to be great. Check it out, megalithicmarvels.com.
So that was Derek. And I have received a collection of these photographs, which I will post this morning for you to see. And you can see there's one of the giant skeleton, actually it's a cranium, complete head of one of these giants. Also the child, there's a child and this pedestal, which is huge. I mean, it's a monstrous pedestal that you can see on the Facebook page. So I'm going to put, I think it's four. Oh, it's actually 6 different photographs that you can see of these giants. And some of them are as tall as 8 feet. So very, very interesting. And, If you have photographs, if you're researching, if you're a scientist, I always welcome your material. You can send it to me personally at cliff@earthancients.com. Or if you're a Facebook member, you can just post it. You can post it on the Facebook page. As many of you know, I've had this fascination with the Maya for three decades, having traveled down to Central America, specifically the Yucatan, over a dozen times, met with a number of elders, and we don't really understand how sophisticated these people were, this culture was. We see their ruins, their pyramids, and we have evidence of high technology in their calendar. I should say calendars. The mathematical computations go back thousands and thousands of years. And in the past, people like Jose Arguelles has written a great deal about these calendars, the encoded information, and how they work with us, how they predict the future and help us understand the past. But there's very, very few people who have really helped us understand the historic notion about these calendars until recently. Carl Johan Kalman is my guest today, and Carl studied these calendars in-depthly. I mean, he's studied them to the point where he has developed a number of theories, and he's written a new book called The Nine Ways of Creation, Quantum Physics, Holographic Evolution, and the Destiny of Humanity. And we have Carl on today to tell us a little bit about this book. Carl, how are you doing?
Yes. Oh, great. Great to be on the show again.
Yeah, wonderful. We talked in your last time you were with us, we talked about another book, but this new book appears to expand on that research. What did you discover in researching the Mayan calendars that are part of this book?
Well, you know, it's somewhat of a change in language. When you talk about the Mayan calendar, you can speak of it in terms of the more ancient mythologies and symbolisms and so forth that they were using for their prophetic purposes about 1,000 years ago or so. That puts you in a certain category. In this case, I've decided not to essentially focus on that language, but instead shift the language over to the language of modern science, and which includes quantum physics and holography, and to make it understandable in those kind of terms. Most of the material here is already known, except that it's now being really coherently presented in such a way that we can understand that the Mayan calendar system described a series of cosmically originating creation waves that is behind all the evolution of our planet. In all aspects, I would say, all the rise and falls of all cultures that we know of and so forth actually goes back to a series of waves. And of course, if it's waves, then that opens up the other language, the language of quantum physics, to be used to understand what the Maya actually were talking about. And I would say this book has a tremendous importance in the sense that if it's true that all evolution of or the cosmos goes back to these waves, which basically seems to have been what the Maya were saying, then it also has a lot of import for where we are now and where the world seems to be going. And so this is unlike the previous book that focuses very much on ancient cultures and sacred geometry and how that went back to the most famous of the Mayan calendar, the Long Count. This book gives the whole perspective, I would say, and really takes us to, for those that study it, and I think this is something that everybody who wants to know where the world is now and where it's going, they should give the Mayan calendar a chance and see that there is some very profound knowledge that they were okay. able to access.
Well, let me ask you, your doctorate's in physical biology, and in the book, you help us understand how the calendar works on a quantum holographic level. Can you just give us a hint at how that is, how a calendar projects itself and is positioned in that area?
Well, I think one of the ways of looking at that is if you take into account a science called cymatics, which is really the study of how particles behave under the influence of vibrations. Which is the same thing as waves, of course. So you from that science, we know that waves can shape matter. And from that perspective, if we believe in the Mayan system that it's a series of waves that they were charting through their calendar, we can also understand how these waves throughout the cosmos would be able to shape matter, to create based on certain geometries that were carried by these waves. The universe has been created, and that includes ourselves. It includes our lives, our physical body, and all the living species on our planet and the universe. It is in a sense that these waves, they carry geometries, and when these geometries are downloaded, they turn into certain structures of matter. And if you look, for instance, on yourself as a physical body, there is a geometry to that physical body, a sacred geometry, okay. You would say.
Let me ask you something, though. Let me just interrupt you real quickly so we get some clarity on waves. Jose Agüelos talked about his understanding that the Maya had he believed the Maya understood that the Earth was constantly bathed in what he called cosmic energy, cosmic waves, if you want to call them. Are you saying that the waves that are bathing Earth are the same waves that he described, just cosmic waves, energetic waves that are directed to us by just the universe, or are these another kind of a wave?
Well, I can't really. I mean, it's a long time ago since he wrote these things, Come a tremendous amount of new information about how the universe first emerged and has developed. In general terms, I would say these waves carry energies, shifting energies, because that's the nature of a sine wave, that there is one energy when there is a peak, and there is another energy when there is a valley. I don't think there is any conflict in the language, but I do want to say that so much more is known today compared to 1987 as to especially the birth of the universe is something that's changing very much and has a tremendous relevance for how everything in the universe is created with its particular geometries and so forth.
Okay, interesting. So how do these waves affect us? Do they affect us on an evolutionary scale? Do they affect us just on how we live our daily lives? How do they affect us?
Well, there are nine different waves, and that is the basis for the complexity of the universe. They have nine different frequencies, and depending on the frequencies, the manifestations of these waves will be different. So I would say the four or five lowest of these waves, which are also the waves with the lowest frequencies, they basically create ourselves as biological beings, or they create all the species and including ourselves. Then there are five higher waves that have higher frequencies. And they don't really develop the more material aspects of our beings, but they carry the kind of mind frames that form the basis of the evolution of humanity and our civilizations and our technologies and our religions and our also how we tend to react in our everyday lives. Because at the current time, after 2011, all of these waves are up and running in parallel, and we are resonating with them. And through this resonate, we will create our reality. We will recreate what we download, basically, from these waves.
Interesting. I want to go into the waves a little further as we continue here, but I want you to describe what you call the cosmic tree of life, what you say about its existence, but also you believe it's being covered up. What is the tree of life, cosmic tree of life?
Well, to begin with, it is, you know, one of those myths, you might call them, that has been the most widespread on our planet. You will find people talking about the tree of life almost everywhere you go. And cultures independently have developed some kind of beliefs as to what this tree is. So it's not only the Maya that had this belief. You will find it among the in ancient Scandinavia. You will find it among the Bushmen. You will find it among the Maori. You find it from all the corners of the world. And that, you know, raises the question, where does this idea come from? Because it was also held in a very significant place in the cosmologies of these ancient peoples. Like to the Maya, the calendar originated from the tree of life. And we have the same concept in the book of Genesis, basically the first book of the Bible, talking about the creation of humanity that has, in a very significant place, the tree of life. So it is a significant idea that prevails all over the world. The question is then really, was this just some idea that people were making up, or is there some kind of a reality to it? And that's what I refer to when I said that so much has changed when it comes to the perception of the birth of the universe compared to in 1987 when practically nothing was said, known about this. And so what has emerged in only the past 10 years or so through satellite measurements of the so-called cosmic microwave background radiation, which is an afterglow from the initial burst of energy that initiated the universe. What's been discovered in these past 10 years is that it wasn't just a big explosion, as was thought before, which was called the Big Bang. Instead, the knowledge is emerging from these cosmological studies by modern science that from the very onset, from the very outset, the universe had a structure. And most importantly in this is that it had a central axis. And that's sort of the basis of all the central axes that that exist in the universe. It's the origin of all the geometries that exist and manifest in the form of human beings and other animals. And this changes things because it tells us that, well, somehow the ancient peoples had the intuition to know that at the heart of the universe there was a big cosmic axis, and that's what they call the tree of life, which actually then is the origin of creation as it's playing out here. And that's it's a huge change in perception step for those that follow this line of research, which I have, or who read, could read my book and see it summarized, that it wasn't just an accident, it wasn't just an explosion that started the universe. It was actually the emergence of a cosmic axis, or the if you like to speak the language of the ancients, it was the emergence of a tree of life. And this creates a big change in perception as to why we are here and where things are going. Because this tree of life, or the cosmic axis, it plays a very significant role in driving and directing evolution.
When you say it's being covered up, though, are you referring to current science not paying attention to it, or are you saying that they are not looking at the research and taking it seriously?
What I'm saying here is that yes, they have found this is mainstream science, and they are the ones that have found these structures. But what I'm saying is that they are not letting people know about it to the extent that it deserves to be known. It's presented as some kind of a sideline in something unimportant or so. I did quote how Wikipedia treats this. They say, well, this axis has been confirmed by two independent satellite measurements. It is the most significant cosmological laboratories in the world that are actually making these studies. And yet, it's not out there. People don't know it, and it's something that has a tremendous importance as to who we are. Because if we are to understand who we are, we have to know what the origin of the universe is.
Okay, that's interesting. I have to ask you though. There's a portion of your book that says evolution on Earth is determined by an ET source. Now, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of speculation. The further out we go in science, our satellites are now looking at hundreds of light years away, planetary systems. And there's one, I can't think of the name of it, that appears to have a huge object floating in front of it. I can't remember the name of the planet, but which could be a source of, could be pulsing some energy. Maybe there's other planets that are pulsing energy. When you say an ET source, what does that mean?
Well, it just means extraterrestrial in a general sense. I, maybe I didn't use the right wording here. I don't mean extraterrestrial being, so to speak, but I do mean, and that's the whole thing about this cosmic axis that has been discovered, the Tree of Life. That is an extraterrestrial. It's outside of the Earth. The evolution on our planet is not just determined by factors on our own planet. Instead, this Tree of Life broadcasts waves all across the universe and creates life and planets with probably intelligent beings, because these waves carry the mind. And if the mind is carried throughout the universe, you will have intelligent beings throughout the universe. But it is an extraterrestrial source. What is happening here, and this is very much unlike what is presented in the evolutionary theories of mainstream science, where the belief is that life emerged by accident on our planet. And then, of course, everything that followed will be looked upon as accidents. Here, it's a view where there is an extraterrestrial source, a cosmic tree of life, that through the waves it is broadcasting through the universe, influences these waves, ups and downs, these peaks and valleys, are what is creating life in all of its aspects all across the universe.
That's interesting. I mean, there's other authors that have written about, you might even call them biological waves, which come, they bathe the earth and help mankind grow in an evolutionary pattern, because they influence the brain, they help the brain grow. There could the human being on Earth could be bathed in these waves that somehow enhance our intelligence, enhance our physicality in some way. What do you say about the physical manifestations of those waves?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And the book is about sort of showing through the evidence of how evolution has been progressing step by step. It's not just sort of just in general saying that there are waves around there. It is about demonstrating that with every peak in certain of these creation waves, you will see an advancement of the kind of life forms that exist on our planet. So it really provides an evidence for this this idea that there are waves that are influencing evolution, including ourselves very much, not only as biological species, but our entire perception of the world and our the entire ways that we have recreated the world in the external reality through our civilizations and technologies and so forth.
You describe the waves in terms of historic events, but is there a way, and maybe this is how we measure these waves? You describe, you know, nine waves of creation. Now, how do we measure these waves? How do we know they are hitting us? And what are the signs of these waves?
Yeah, that is you can't measure these waves directly, as far as I can tell. So you may wonder, how did the Maya access them? Well, it is because it's these are waves that influence our minds. And so the Maya in their time must have had a more developed way of experiencing the effects of the ups and downs of these waves. So there is, at the current time, I do not think there is any direct means of measuring these waves. And part of the reason is that the wavelengths are so long that there wouldn't be any. We're talking about maybe billions of light years in some cases. that there are no antennas that would be able to take them down, so to speak. But we know about them because these are the waves that the Maya left behind. And when we look at how the rise and fall of human civilizations compared to these waves, we find that they match up with the waves. And the Maya, you know, for instance, the classical Mayan civilization, the one in Guatemala and Chiapas, it disappeared very abruptly, as far as people can say, at one of these shift points between a night and a day, or a valley and a peak. And the post-classical Mayan civilization, the one of Chichen Itza and at the Yucatan, it disappeared when a certain peak went into a valley. Those shifts apparently have a significant bearing on the rise of and fall of civilization, and the reason they do so is that they have a direct influence on our minds. And so people that are sensitive to these effects on our minds, they will also be able to chart the changes and make calendars of it. And this is what the Maya happened to do. And even though we have information that are similar from very many different parts of the world, the Maya were the ones that created a calendar system. And that's what makes them unique.
It's almost like the Maya had a multidimensional sense of things, the universe. And we've had other people on this show that say that mankind, 1,000 years plus years ago, was a different type of human being, and those that lived by the earth and the energetics of the earth seemed to have a sense of the universe, the sense of their surroundings, almost on multidimensional levels. And to create this calendar as they did, that goes thousands of years in the past, and in some cases they found stelae that are thousands and thousands and millions of years in the future and the past, maybe we're not looking at these people quite right. Maybe science needs to look at them as a multidimensional or intelligence going on with these people to create this these calendars. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, what this my work is all about is to demonstrate how human beings are changing under the influence of these waves, and that change is primarily changed in the human mind. But as the mind changes, it also means that the perception of reality that people have will change in different eras. And so that's exactly what this is about. But it's also being a very precise work, because it's not just a general statement that people might have been receptive to other kinds of waves in the past. It is seeing when and how these shifting waves have been active and the kind of effects that they've had on human beings. I wanted to add something here. Based on you talked about the Amazonian civilization that is now being discovered, and which is a fascinating thing. But one of the things that we know from the Amazonian peoples is that they perceived the human beings as being children of the great anaconda, of a serpent, in other words. And, you know, you have the same thing from the Maya and the Aztecs, the plumed serpent. And you have the biblical tree of life with the serpent coming with information to Adam and Eve, the primordial humans. And you have the rainbow of serpent in the creator god of the aborigines in Australia. And what I'm saying here is that what the ancient people talked about as these creator serpents, that is exactly what we with a modern language can understand as these creation waves. So this idea is not only the tree of life, the nine levels, but it's also the serpent that was very, very widespread as a symbol and myth in the ancient cosmologies. And what they're talking about is exactly the same thing. These serpents were symbols of the creation wave, the sine waves that is underlying all of evolution, and they knew it. But what makes the Maya unique is that they charted. Not only they didn't just say that this is the plumed serpent or a sine wave functions with its ups and downs. They charted when does this go into a peak and when does it go into a valley. And from that was their whole basis of their prophetic art, to be able to chart these waves.
Interesting. I again have to repeat that it seems like they, the Maya, and the people in those earlier times had a different kind of brain makeup, and they were on a different evolutionary scale, consciously or cognitively, to be able to pick up these subtle vibrations and have an understanding of them. I want you to talk a little bit about the ninth wave activation, which you say happened in 2011. Can you describe some of the world activities that were going on during that time that kind of delineate the ninth wave?
Yeah. So then there are nine waves of creation, and they have different frequencies. And over time, when new waves have been activated, they've had a frequency that is 20 times higher. And this is what is behind the perception that many people have today of a speed-up of time. Because the ninth wave that was added fairly recently and sort of completes the full picture of waves that are active, that has the highest. The ninth wave has the highest of these frequencies, and so a wavelength in the ninth wave only has the duration of 36 common days, and this particular wave then it carries a mind, a new kind of mind that allows for a return to the kind of unity consciousness that humanity had at an earlier point. And the immediate effect that we saw of the activation of this was really the whole year of 2011, which was a big year protests all around the world, the Occupy movement, the Arab Spring, and all kinds of things happened in politically speaking in the world, and we can understand this because at the time there were protests against bankers, against dictators, and so forth. And that came out of the shift in perception that this new mind brought. It brought this unity consciousness, and as that happened, people started to see that the world that they were living in was not consistent with this new frame of mind. Then there is the story why this movement did not immediately continue, and I explain this from the perspective of the Mayan calendar. But this wave is really the one that defines the destiny of humanity. And so that's a significant message of this book, that this is a wave that people need to learn to connect to. And it's quite feasible, so to speak. This is the most important aspect of the Mayan calendar system for people to follow, because that's the one that not only is the highest of the nine waves, with the highest frequency wave, but it's also, these waves have a direction. And this shift in the mind that was carried by this ninth wave is the one that leads into the future of based on a unity mind.
Okay, so if this is the last wave, the ninth wave, what can we do as Earthlings to access this ninth wave? And what to become more attuned with it?
Well, the thing to, you know, that's in my book, the references to the calculators. And you can also go to my website, kalleman.com, kalleman.com. And there are a couple of articles there on my blog that talks about where you can access this ninth wave. You can also go to my Facebook page, which is called the Nine Waves of Creation, Mayan calendar, where you can directly access this calculator. Mm-hmm. The point to realize is that that what this work is about, and what the Maya would realize, was that these waves and their peaks and valleys, they create times of forward movement, which are the peak times, and which alternate with the periods that are resting or destructive periods, dark ages. And this is very clearly manifesting in human history. If you actually know where these shift points are, and the nature of the mind that is being, the global mind that is being carried by these waves. And the logic then becomes that if we want to become part of manifesting what is truly the destiny of humanity, ultimately originating from the tree of life, but if we want to be part of that, we should really pay attention to what is happening in the day times, in the peak times of this, and let ourselves become create the resonance with these waves, listening to the guidance we get, and follow the shift points and so forth. You know, this is just one of the aspects of it, but. You know, what I think my book carries, in addition to this more practical tool for being part of the manifesting the destiny of the humanity, is the knowledge that no matter how chaotic the world may look at the current time, it is still very much part of the kind of directed movement of evolution that these waves are creating. And that we are all, things are not accidental. There is an overlaying plan, you might even talk about, that is carried out by these waves. And that knowledge, I think, is, you don't really get it anywhere else to that extent, to the extent that it's actually verified through the effects in the past of these different waves. That is a very significant aspect as well of this particular book.
Okay. So what can we know on a prediction base? What's going to happen in the future, in the next few years or in the next decade within this ninth wave activation? What do you predict?
Yeah. So the first thing to know then is that there are nine different waves, and different people are in resonance with different waves. And so depending on what waves we are in resonance with, we will tend to have different political views. We will have tend to look upon the future and our own intentions differently, and so forth. So it has a lot to do about sort of choosing the frequency that we want to tune into. And what this also means that is that not everyone is affected similarly by these different waves, because there are different waves to tune into. And it's almost like, you know, different frequencies on the radio that, where we have a choice. And depending on what we listen to, we will come to have different views. And so really exactly what will happen will depend on to what extent people become aware of what actually drives evolution and how they relate to that, what the kind of intentions that they create based on this as to what the future will look like. So at the current time, the sixth wave, which is the one that has created civilization, is on a downturn. And there is a tremendous shake-up in the kind of world order that has been established, especially by the Western powers, throughout the past 400 years. So that's one of the things that is happening, and it really has a lot to do with the Brexit and the Trump administration and so forth. It's sort of coming there. This new nationalist, you might say, is coming actually as a reaction to this shift down in that particular wave. But then it's not as simple as that. Because, as I said, there are nine waves of creation, and people resonate with different waves. And so there are other waves, like the eighth wave, that basically brings a more feminine perception that brings into the digital revolution, into deeper manifestations. And then on top of that, it's the ninth wave that ultimately is the one that is meant to recreate the unity of the past. And so depending on what people resonate with, that's why you see this big split going on. There's no question about the divisiveness in the United States at the current time, because people are in resonance with different waves. But if I'm to predict something, I would say that the next decade or something like that will be very, very difficult for humanity. Again, the in the long term, it is now the eighth and the ninth wave that is increasingly becoming strengthened. And you know, the ninth wave was activated only 6 years ago, and that means that, you know, in order to have been fully born into the resonance with this wave, you have to be less than 6 years of age. And we know that people below 6 years of age, you know, they may be a very new, interesting kind of human being, but it takes a while until they have an effect on the way that society at large is being shaped. At a minimum, I would say, at least from past experience, it would be 20 years of age that people, but more likely 30 years of age. But it's over time, this is what will be the lasting effect of these nine waves of creation. So
that's quite interesting what you just said, that a 6-year-old is carrying a certain resonance. They're projecting a frequency, and that each generation, each age group has a frequency of their own, which permeates and affects the rest of us. I find that's quite fascinating. And interesting to consider.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, when people talk about these, there used to be previously a big interest in these indigo children and crystal children and what
yeah.
they're called. What that really is that when a new wave is becoming activated, and there were a couple of new waves in 1986, 1999, and then most importantly, of course, 2011, what happens is that a new mind, a new frame of mind becomes downloadable that mm-hmm. wasn't downloadable before that. And as a result, the ones that are the most affected by this new wave are the small children. And so they start to download another frame of mind that makes them look at reality in a new way. And then the old people, they will say, oh, they are different. And they will give names to them as crystals or indigo or so forth. But this is how evolution works based on nine waves, that new waves are being activated according to a certain time plan that the mind would be charting, and only as that progresses over time, eventually the ninth wave will take full maturation and be channeled through these new generations. Mm-hmm. But we're all influenced by it, but we weren't born into it.
It's quite interesting. I keep hearing that. These waves, and I'm thinking of the Indian yugas and how they go into millions and millions of years as civilization rises intellectually and then spiritually and then falls into decay only to be rebuilt again and then continue on. It's almost like the different waves, one through nine, have captured us at different points in our evolution, and the first wave, the second wave, the third wave all carry and provide us with certain information which helps evolution. Mm-hmm. And then the ninth wave, which in the yugas, I think it's the Kali Yuga we're in right now, which is completing a cycle and beginning another very enlightened cycle. So we're kind of in the darkest point of the final cycle, getting ready for the new part. So kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well
fascinating. The book is called The Nine Ways of Creation, Quantum Physics, Holographic Evolution, and the Destiny of Humanity. Very, very interesting. My guest has been Dr. Carl Johan Kalman. I mean, there's so much turmoil in the United States right now. I mean, is this part of this ninth wave? Is this a prediction that you've had, or what do you see for that?
Well, I think that is primarily caused by the shift, the sixth wave going into a night. All the waves shifted in 2011, in late 2011, and so they're all having it's a complex result of such a huge shift influencing nine different waves simultaneously. Mm-hmm. But most importantly, it is that the sixth wave, which created the British Empire and later the American Empire, that is now going into a night, but it's not the only one, which is it's a dark age in a sense, and I would say a lot of the expressions that you see at the current time in the world with a lot of fake information coming out is an expression of a dark age. But I'm not saying that we are totally speaking going into a dark age, because there are other people that are in resonance with these higher waves and want to manifest a world that is consistent with that and bring unity rather than divisiveness and so forth. This is what is playing out, the combined effect of the shifts in these different waves.
Fascinating. For those of you who are listening, you can read more about Dr. Kalman's new book, The Nine Ways of Creation. His website is Kalman.com. That's CALLEMAN.com. He's got a blog on here, and he's got quite a, I think he's got, you have articles on here, right? Or that's your blog.
Yeah. Well, there's a blog.
Yeah, which is the same thing. Fantastic. Yeah. Dr. Kalman, thank you very much. It's been quite enlightening. I think we're getting a taste of being able to predict our future in certain ways by following this information. So it's fascinating work. Thank you very much. That was fun.
Thanks, Cliff. Thanks. I really appreciate listening to this, your program in the beginning as well before I came in. It's great information you're providing. Yeah.
Great. Okay, we'll be back with you. Thanks. Take care.
Thank you.
So that was Dr. Carl Johan Kalman and the book, The Nine Ways of Creation. Again, that website, Kalman.com, has a lot of information on his book and in his theories and some predicting things there too. So kind of cool. All right, so that's it for today. My guest next week is Freddie Silva, and he has written a book called The Lost Art of Resurrection, which is fascinating. Initiation, Secret Chambers, and the Quest for the Other World. And this is something that we don't talk enough about, which is the earlier civilizations were very big on initiation, transformation of the body, mind, and spirit through ritual, through sacred practices, and why more of us need to do these things to tap into higher levels of consciousness. So that's next week on the program. All right. I hope you have a wonderful day. Take care.
Run to Old Navy tomorrow and Saturday for the year's biggest denim deal. 2 days only, all jeans are 50% off. That's right, tomorrow and Saturday, all jeans are 50% off at Old Navy and OldNavy.com. But you'd better hurry. It ends Saturday. Valid 224 and 225. Excludes clearance.
Guy knows not to judge a man by his car's multicolored paint job or absence of modern gadgetry. Who cares if it's technically old enough to vote and the windows are powered by the strength of your left arm? Your monthly payment is zero, and it'll stay that way. Because with over 500,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep anything on the road. She may not be pretty, but she's all yours. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.